everybody. Today, we'll continue on to do the next major segment here of this Perek Hey, of this very lengthy fifth Perek of the Be'er HaGoyim of the Netzach Yisrael. And the piece which we're up to is the piece about Titus. Right? Titus was the one who was sent to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. He was the one who Aspasianus sent to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. Ozel Shadrei leTitus. And the Gemara tells us, we'll run through the story of Titus. It takes up the bottom half of the page Nun Vavim and Beis in Maseches Gittin. And we'll run through it, and then we will analyze it. It's on page Lamed Aleph in the Classic Edition, page Kuf Yud Dalet in the Hartman Edition. Ozel Shadrei leTitus, he sent Titus for Amar, and he said, Eloi kemei tzur chasayubai. The Pasuk says, and they will say, right, the Goyim will say, this says in the Tochacha, in the dire words of warning and rebuke, where is their God, the rock in whom they place their hope? Zeh Titus HaRasha. This was could be a quote from Titus. Shechirev v'gidev klapei mala, that he blasphemed and he spoke viciously and harshly against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ma asa, what did he do? He took a zayna and he went into the Kodesh HaKadoshim and he spread out the Sefer Torah and he was over Allah Avera and he transgressed a terrible sin on the, he was with her, the way the Gemara says, there in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And then, and he took a sword and he stuck it into the pareiches, the curtain that separated between the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and miraculously blood started spurting from that spot. He thought, he had the impression somehow that he had killed, heaven forbid, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam himself. As it says, Like your enemies have cried, have screamed in the midst of your meeting place, they made their signs as signs. In other words, thank you. It was what they took as an indication of the destruction of the Mikdash. So that's the first stage. You know what? I think that in fact maybe we'll pause here. Well, instead of going through the whole Gemara, we'll go through later pieces of Mir Hashem as it comes time to analyze them, instead of biting off more than we can chew, especially in the spirit of munchkins instead of donuts at the table. So the phenomenon here of Titus, who's characterized by this very, very strong derision and destruction of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the Mikdash. So the Maral begins his analysis of Titus with a few questions. And the first question, and it's a very delicate and important and interesting question, is that he says, you know, we just learned in the Gemara last time, in the last piece, we discussed it last time, last week, was that when Rabbi Yechem and Zakkai went out to Aspasianus, to Vespasian, so he said, hello, king. Right, Shalom, right, Malka. So he says, king, I'm not the king. He says, you have to be the king. Because the Beis HaMikdash can only fall in the hands of the king. Halavonain ba'adir yipol. And we talked about it last time, because the Beis HaMikdash is so sublime, it's so above and beyond everything else, it can't be destroyed in a simple pedestrian fashion. It has to be by somebody who himself has some greatness, not necessarily goodness, but some greatness to him. So says the Maral, how can we have this kind of a davar p'chisus? Right, that the king should go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim with a zayna and with a prostitute and be over and aveira in the Holy of Holies. I mean, look, he wants to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. That's one thing. But this is so base and so vulgar that it doesn't fit this characterization of an adir, of a great man, in some sense, who's coming to destroy the Beis HaMikdash with whatever enmity. But how is it? It's so vulgar. It's such a non-class act. How could it be? How could the Beis HaMikdash fall in that thing? And second thing he says is, you know, what's this ness of the blood oozing out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim? I mean, you know, like, what was the purpose, right? It's a miracle. Miracles usually happen, you know, for some purpose, for some goal. Like, what was the idea? What was the idea? And finally, he wants to know why HaKadosh Baruch Hu is silent, which is the next piece of the Gemara. So he says like this. There's a little bit of an aside here that the Maharal addresses, and we're not going to dwell on it. But he says that, you know, there was a historian, Yosefun, right? There was a historian, a Roman historian, Josephus Flavius, a Jewish, Yosefun Ben Gurion, and they had histories of the time. And Yosefun, which was a studied work, you still have it. Again, it's the Jewish version, so to speak, of Josephus. Yosefun gives Titus a lot of credit. He says that Titus was really not so. I mean, he destroyed the Beis Hamikdash, but he really didn't want to. You know, in other words, he wanted to bring things down. But you could just put the box on another chair. He wanted to bring things down, but he did not want to see it burned. He wanted to salvage it. You know, he makes nice things to some degree about Titus, describes him in some humanitarian light, in some respectful light.
And the
Maharal is absolutely, absolutely opposed to this. He says Titus, who destroyed the Beis Hamikdash, was the ultimate Russia. So when we're going to have characterizations of him, yes, Maharal is still going to explain. He may have been a Russia that was, so to speak, a little bit more of a class act than the way the Gemara makes it sound, but nevertheless, he was a Russia. He was evil personified. And he explains as follows, and this is a big aside, a very important principle, which we have touched upon before, we have discussed before, but not recently, but it's very important in understanding, you know, the ultimate span of the Netzach Yisrael, which is understanding the Golios. He says, Nebuchadnezzar, who destroyed the first Beis HaMikdash, even though the first Beis HaMikdash was a greater Beis HaMikdash, was not as great a Russia as Titus, who destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash. And the idea is like this. You know, there are different Mishalim that are used for this. You know, the Golios, the various exiles, the various powers that arose, were envisioned in different ways. And the one which he chooses here in the Netzach to use as the example is where he saw the Golos, the power of the Babylonian Empire, represented by the golden head, and whereas he saw the power of the Roman Empire as the steel, as not steel but iron, right? Barzel. So what's the difference between them? So I would prefer just to start with explaining it from another source, which also the Maharal and others all explain, which is that Nebuchadnezzar was compared to the lion, right? Which you find that also in the Nevuos of Daniel, whereas Titus and the Romans were compared to the Nachash, to the snake. And the Gemara says, what's the difference between the Nachash and the Ari? The Ari, the lion, is Dairis Va'echel. The Ari pounces upon something, rips it to shreds and eats it. The lion destroys because it's a carnivore and it's hungry and it wants to pounce on something in order to eat it. I don't know when a lion isn't hungry, so I'm not going to suggest any kind of a test of this. But if you were to chance upon a lion that was no longer hungry and you did not do something specifically to agitate it, you would be safe with it. The Nachash, says the Gemara, the Nachash Dairis Veinaychel, the Nachash is a destroyer. It's not a matter of hunger. It's a matter of viciousness. It's a matter of just wanting to destroy. Nachash Dairis Veinaychel. Nebuchadnezzar was trying, Veinaychel, I'm sorry, and he doesn't eat, thank you. That's the contrast between them. Nebuchadnezzar, he had a kingdom, right? He was the Babylonian Empire. He was building, he was expanding. The Jewish people, the land of Israel, was to be part of his scheme, was to be part of his area. Nebuchadnezzar, we find him in many ways described in certain lofty terms. He was a man with clearly a spiritual sensitivity. You read the book of Daniel, you read a book about the revelations of Nebuchadnezzar, the letters which he sent to his kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar was not completely out of the picture, beyond the pale. However, Nebuchadnezzar was also very much power hungry. He wanted to see his kingdom grow. He wanted everything to be under him in so many ways. And so, when the Jewish people were not subordinate, when they did not submit, so that's what happened as well. That became the destruction of Beis HaMikdash. Beis HaMikdash was very much part of his empire building. Titus, the Edomim, the Romans, while they were also empire builders, of course they were empire builders, but it wasn't simply for their own satisfaction that this happened. It was the murderous pleasure. It was the pleasure simply of destruction, of destroying something that's there just because it's there, just because it's good. If one wants to bring a dimion to this, you know, it's sometimes hard to be scientific about these things. But if you think about the last days of the Second World War, right, the heirs to the Roman Empire, the Germania, the Germans, which is somehow associated with the Amalekim, as you see from different things. But in any case, you know, this kind of a thing. So what happens? So everybody knows the famous desperation, the days of desperation. Many of the generals and the strategists of Hitler, Yimach Shemai v'Zichroi, said, okay, let's use these efforts, let's fight on this front, let's fight on that front. And he was hell-bent on using those same resources in order to be able to do more damage, to exterminate more and more and more of us, more and more of the Eden. In other words, while in a certain sense it's a battle of the empire, to take over the world, which was certainly part of the picture, but there's also this destructive desire that's there very, very much at the core. And you have both elements. You have both elements in the Roman Empire also. Of course, the Roman Empire was an empire not just of destruction, but it was an empire of building as well. But the viciousness, the desire to destroy is harder and stronger than anything. So on the one hand, it's compared to a nachash. On the other hand, it's compared to the barzel, to the iron. The iron is not a precious metal. The iron is a metal which is a tool of weaponry, a tool of destruction. Like sonif aleim barzel, when it comes to mizbeach, its definition, its character is a destructive character. Whereas bavel is compared to zahav. Zahav is a precious metal. Its definition is because of its significance, because of its importance. Its desire for power, for breadth, for wealth, like we learned a couple of weeks ago when we talked about the different facets of wealth, was the chashivus, the significance that they wanted as a result, the honor that they wanted as a result. It wasn't a diabolical hatred of that which was good, of that which was present. Says the Maharal, that's the way we're supposed to view Titus. Titus Harasha, Titus the evil one, whose desire is evil and his desire is destruction of good. And that's what we're experiencing here in Titus's destruction as the one to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. That said, so let's get to the story. So he comes and he takes the Zayna into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. How could he do this? What kind of a class act is this for Titus to be able to perform? So the Maral comes here and he explains this Agada in the fashion, one of the important fashions of explaining Agada. And that is, that explains that Titus never took a Zayna into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. He never took a woman into the Kodesh HaKadoshim and acted with her there on a Sefer Torah. It's not what happened. The Gemara says it. The Gemara says it in its metaphoric language of Chazal. Remember Amelia Bedelia. You got to know that sometimes Chazal are saying something and it's exactly what they're saying. However, you have to understand the deeper meaning of what it is. And sometimes Chazal speak in ways which are simile, in ways which are metaphor. When it says that Vashti grew a tail, it doesn't necessarily mean that she grew a tail. Right, you have to understand that sometimes what we teach us, this is the way to read Divrei Chachamim. You know, those of you who were with us with Be'er HaGoyla, when we started the Be'er HaGoyla, so we explained basically we as always explain when we learn Medrashei Chazal, the Rambam's introduction to looking at Agodais, which he says in his commentary to the Mishnah, in his introduction. To Chelek, says that there are three kinds of ways people will read a Chazal. Sometimes they will read it and they will take it literally and they will swallow it whole and they'll believe things which are absurd. They sound absurd. But they say that's what Chazal says, so they're just going to follow it, swallow it whole. And sometimes they'll read it, and they'll say, another group of people reads it, and they say, this is absurd, this is ridiculous, the sages, they're a bunch of pea brains, they're crazy, they're fantastic, spinning fairy tales, forget about it. Those are the two major groups that read the words of Chazal, says the Rambam. And then there's the smallest group that reads the words of Chazal. And they say, you know, look, I mean, they didn't just write this page with this story on it. They wrote the whole Mishnah, the whole Gemara. I mean, these were wise, smart, logical, analytic people. Right? So these are smart people. These are not crazy. Now, on the other hand, you read this thing, and it just doesn't make sense. They're not going to, like, shut their brain off, right? It doesn't sound right. So they must mean something else. And the mushal which I like to give to this is, you know, three people, right? They have their little shortwave radio club, which... when I say this sometimes to the students upstairs, I have to explain to them what the shortwave radio is, and we started switching it to like a chat room or something, you know. But they have their shortwave club, and they get together every Tuesday night, and they, you know, they try to listen to something interesting. And one Tuesday night they show up, and the fellow says, pulls out a scrap of paper from his pocket, and he says, "You won't believe it, guys, I got the CIA's frequency. I got the CIA's frequency, and we're going to listen tonight to the CIA," and they spin the dials, and they hone in on the station, and the station crackles and comes on, and they hear, "Go immediately to the supermarket and buy some purple tomatoes." Right, so the three guys are there. "Go immediately to the supermarket and buy some purple tomatoes." So one of them jumps up, gets his raincoat, runs out to the supermarket, first supermarket he finds, runs in, says, "Can I have some purple tomatoes?" And the guy who's, you know, restocking the produce stand looks at him like a meshuggener. He's ready to call the guys with the white coats to take him away, or maybe throw him in the fruit bin. So that's one person. Second person says, "Oh my gosh, you know, I listen to these guys on the right wing radio. They talk about the evils of government all the time. They're all crazy. They're all nuts. Indeed." They are nuts. Look at this. I mean, this is the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States of America, and all they can talk about is, "Go to the supermarket and buy purple tomatoes. I never heard anything so ridiculous in my life. Let's switch to the Golden Oldie station." And the third one says, "You know something? This is the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States. You know, maybe they're not perfect, but idiots they're not. That's for sure. I mean, these are people who are serious people trying to do their job. On the other hand, go to the market and buy purple tomatoes? They must be speaking in code. There must be something there that's deeper here. It's not to be read simply on the surface." And that's what we have to do. And that, says the Rambam, that's the way a person has to listen to Divrei Chazal. And it requires discernment. And sometimes it means, again, yeah, the words mean what the words mean, but you have to understand a deeper meaning of the words. And sometimes the words are really a code. They're symbolic. They're expressing something. So what's the idea here? What would this be? So again, this is the bombshell of the Maharal in this Gemara. You know, one could easily have, right? And it's because of such a subtle question, you know, vulgar, how could he do something like that, you know, to the Kodesh HaKadoshim? Even though he was evil, even though he was destructive. So the Maharal says like this, and this analysis is, you know, in the middle of his, towards the beginning, but in the middle of his piece, Kuf Yud Ches, in the thing, I'm in the middle of the first column. Pirush Harosha Hazeh Kasher Nichnas L'Mokam HaKadosh L'Chav L'Yisrael Ein Safek Sheyoytzei Mishus HaKadosh Baruch Hu V'Davak V'Elohei Nechor. He was going into Hashem's domain, and he was trying to destroy. He was trying to destroy the Mikdash. So he's turning away from Hashem. He's turning away from Hashem, and he's attaching himself to some degree to foreign gods, the foreign forces. V'zeh nikro she'tofas zayna. Ki avayda zara nimshelo kezayna. Avayda zara is always compared to a zayna. To a harlot, to a prostitute. Ki b'chol mokam gabi avayda zara ksiv zayna. V'lo yisbuchu oi zivcheim lasir mashayim zaynim achareim. V'chrati yaisoi v'yaskol ha-zaynim achrov. V'lo yisasuru achri levavchem v'achrei nechem al v'yisei avidei asher atem zaynim achareim. Don't stray after your eyes that you are zaynim, that you stray after them. The term zayna means to stray. It means to go away from the area of, from the direction of real connection, of loyalty, to go afield. That's the idea. So the zayna is, the zayna that he brought in, so to speak, is this idea of straying and trying to break the ultimate chibur, the ultimate connection. You know that Hashem gave Moshe Rabbeinu two luchos, two tablets, each one with five sets, with five mitzvahs on them. And we know that what's the difference between the luchos rishonos, the first luach and the second luach, the first tablet and the second tablet, is that the first one really governs laws with the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, with those above us, Rabbeinu Shel Olam and our parents, and the second one is Bein Adam LaChaveiro. But there's also understood that there's a parallel between the first one on this side and the first one on that side, the second one on this side, the second one on that side. And the second one on the first side is, you should not worship other gods. The second one on the second side is, Lo Sinav. You should not commit adultery. This is the metaphor. The relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a connection which is considered to be a serious, loyal embrace and a connection. And as the Maharal goes on to explain, you know, this is what we know from the whole image which is being created in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. What was the image in the Kodesh HaKadoshim? It was the Kruvim. It was those two angels, the two cherubic images, both the ones that Moshe Rabbeinu fixed onto the lid of the Arayin, of the Tzalo, and the ones which Shlomo HaMelech built when he built the Beis HaMikdash that stood, you know, towering over the Arayin. And those Kruvim were the image of a male and the image of a female, and they would be locked in an embrace to indicate the connection between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael, between Hashem and the Jewish people. Because, indeed, the Kodesh HaKadoshim is supposed to be the private place of the complete and total chibur, connection between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael. It's the place of the Orein HaBris, the Ark of the Bris, of the Covenant. The Luchos are the Luchos HaBris. The Sefer Torah is referred to in the Chumash as the Sefer HaBris. What's a Bris? A Bris is where you describe such a bond, such a covenant, that the symbolic expression of a Bris is always that you have something and you cut it in half. Why? Because we're saying, you know something, two separate pieces, but it's two halves of one whole. Two halves of one whole. So it's more than, okay, here I am. I'm an independent person, and I'm going to be contracting to do something for you. Right? Here I am, I have my independent corporation. You're outsourcing whatever it is to me. I'm me, you're you, and I'm doing something for you. Now that's a shvua, that's a commitment, that's a bond. Bris is where we're saying, no, this is going to be a merger. This is going to be a joining together of the two parts that were like one. And that is really, really what we describe as the ultimate term of relationship. A marriage is described this way. Eishes berisecha, right? The wife of your covenant. This is the idea. It's supposed to be this kind of a thing, of a melding, like we have in the original description, right? Adam had woman splintered off from him, and then they came back together. It was like one originally, you know, organically whole unit, together as one. Zanus, the description of Zanus, really the failure, really of a relationship, is where the person indeed is involved in, you know, just a meeting up with, you know, a meeting up with somebody, where the connection isn't really there, but it's just a rendezvous, it's just a relationship without commitment. This is a very, very important thing. You know, when you speak using the metaphor of the Gemara, the halachas which govern this, where the Gemara speaks about the need when even a husband and wife are together with each other, sometimes the Gemara says if it's like this, then it's like znus, right? Without ksuba, you know, or something like that. In other words, the idea is because ksuba is something which is supposed to solidify the commitment. Ksuba means that it's not easy come, easy go. So therefore, they're going to be more bound to each other without the ksuba. So then, it's going to be considered to be like zanus. The b'nei teisha midos, which the Gemara discusses, where a person is not supposed to be intimate with his wife when he's either distracted, when he's not really connected, when he would have his mind, heaven forbid, on somebody else, when he's not planning to stay with her. Because then it's not an act of bris, it's not an act of connection. It's just, you know, two separate people getting together. You know how the Ramban explains, the Ravid explains, that this is the reason why HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when he created Adam, male and female, he created them out of one piece. When he created the animals, right, he created male animals and female animals. He didn't put them to sleep and take out a rib and create a female cow or whatever the proper terminology would be. He didn't do that. He created them together. He created them separately because that's all they would ever be, right? They would be two separate beings that would get together for a specific need of theirs and then separate again. A certain form of just, you know, like a coming and going, an outsourcing kind of a thing. By Adam, the idea was it was supposed to be a real chibur, a real connection. And that's the metaphor to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The inner sanctum, the Kodesh HaKadoshim, which describes the intensity of the relationship of the bris, of the connection between Kol Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And what Titus was trying to do was he was trying to sever that connection. And sever that connection by Avodah Zarah, by a worship of things that don't have this kind of connection. By just, you know, an alignment of the sun and the moon. Sun and the moon have no connection, right? They're impersonal, right? They're up there in the sky. They're part of the system. They're worshipped as figures, as items that are there that have an effect on our lives, but they are acher, right? You know what the Gemara darshans, how the Gemara explains, Le'yelecha Elohim acherim alpona. You should not have other gods in my presence. The second commandment. What does that mean? Elohim acherim, other gods. Like, it wouldn't have been enough to say Le'yelecha Elohim alpona. You shouldn't have gods in my presence. Elohim acherim is because Acher means a stranger. And Acher means, you know, a distant person, somebody far away. Remember when Lavan said to Yaakov, Yaakov said, oh, you want to give me wages? You know what? I would like you, give me Rachel's hand in marriage. Better if me, Toiv Titi Yisrael, me Titi Yisrael Ish Acher. Right? Rather, I should give her to you than give her to an Ish Acher. What does that mean? What's he saying? Because you're asking him, sorry, you're a relative. Why should I give her to a stranger? Let me give her to a relative. Elohim Acherim is a God that's estranged. Right? You're worshipping these forces of nature, but they don't know you. They don't interact with you. They don't respond to you. It's just there. It's there. It functions. But it has no connection whatsoever.
Acher with a sifre minot.
Right. Well, Acher is it's very good, huh? He was a tan, but when he turned on his chinuch, on his Torah and his teaching, he was called Acher, right? So the Gemara says he was a completely different person, right? That's why he was called Acher. But on the other hand, you know, he was estranged. He was very, very much disconnected. So this is the idea. And remember that Edom, they are the heirs of Esav. And Esav, besides being this destroyer, right? But Esav was the one who his kfira, his heresy, took the form of les din v'les dayan. Right? The world, there's no judge and there's no judgment. The world is, so to speak, blind to what you're doing. You know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, doesn't react personally to anything which anybody does. Les din v'les dayan. And this was the idea of bringing the Zayna into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Whereas the Migdash and the Kodesh HaKadoshim represent the idea of a strong and intimate relationship between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the people and Klal Yisrael and us. What he did was, he said, what are you talking about? This is a one-night stand. This is just a come and go. He brought the Zayna into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. That's the idea. That's the way he portrays it. And he brings many of these things that we're talking about over here in describing it. And he says like this, when he came to the Holy of Holies, to the place of the Oren where the Torah and the Luchai stood, the place which is really specifically capable of having this connection to God, when this Russia came in, she was a Baal Avodah Zarah, to a place of Chibur, Nechshav Dover Zeh Shenechnasim HaZayna. It's like going in there with a Zayna. That's the metaphor which is used. Hu Kayach Avodah Zarah Shalai. And that's what it means. He took the Sefer Torah, and he was over the Avera on it. In other words, he took that which was the Chibur, the connection, and he went and he distorted it. That's the idea. It's this. And this is what he says. And he says, you know something, if you really want, I'll tell you, he actually took a Zayna in there, and he did it. If you want to interpret it literally, we could say that. And we could say, according to the greatness of the evil of this person, even though it was Maguna, but he was so spiteful and so hateful, so he would do this kind of thing. But he says, you know, I'm still inclined not to say that. Why? Because of Yosifun. I don't understand. Yosifun said that he was a nice guy, and he finished saying that he was, he said, what are you talking about? He was terrible. He was evil personified. So Yosifun was fooled because Titus behaved like a class act. Because remember, isn't that Esav always? Esav is compared to the pig that has split hooves. But doesn't chew his cut. He makes himself look good. He goes to his father and he says, you know, I had to separate Meiser on salt. And he's able to put on a good face. So Yosifun says, Amaral, unfortunately Yosifun swallowed it whole. I don't believe it. But a fellow who's trying to put on a good face doesn't take a zona into the Kodesh HaKodashim to be over in Aveira. So therefore I'm disinclined to believe that he would actually do this. Both because he's supposed to be a melech, he's supposed to be a little bit regal, and because of this. But you know, if you don't believe me, if you can't swallow this, that the Gemara is meaning metaphorically, fine, it's okay. He was so evil and so vicious that maybe this would be part of his viciousness to do something so horrible and so spiteful. The main point is that he's coming to try to destroy connection. And I just want to remind you, before we go on to the next piece, that we talked about this really earlier in this Agadita, where we pointed out that everything in the Agaditas of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash has to do with the relationship. It's always the marriage relationship that somehow figures into the story, figures into the metaphor. Whether it's the story of Kamtza Bar Kamtza that to some degree, that starts around the wedding, and likewise the stories of the destruction of Tur Malka and Beitar, those other two, the city which was so populous and the city which was so strong, that both of the issues were, this one was about the chicken, right, the rooster and the hen, and as a school for the marriage, and this one was about the cedar trees that they would plan to build the chuppah from, and many, many other pieces in the Gemara that play on this specific metaphor, because that's what it was about. It was about the connection between Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is described in Shir HaShirim, right, as a relationship between a beloved, right, to the loving couple. That was the issue. And when Titus was doing it, he wasn't just breaking it. The whole idea was, what do you mean, what loving couple? As the world turns, sometimes the stars are aligned this way, sometimes they're aligned that way. There's no Hashem constant who's looking, who's connected, who's interested, who wants to hear what you have to say, who responds to you, who speaks to you. There is no such thing. That was the nature of the destruction. Less din v'less dayan. Nothing really. You're in a world of happenstance. That's the nature of the destruction. And that's described metaphorically by the Zayna on the Sefer Torah. Taking the Sefer Torah, which teaches us, the whole Chibur, the whole connection, Sefer Torah, which is really the expression of how we connect to Hashem most immediately. The Sefer Torah, when we learn Torah, it's supposed to be as if Hashem is speaking to us at that moment and we are engaged in conversation with Him. It's when Shir HaShirim begins, Yishakeni Mineshikais Piyu, He kisses me on the lips, He kisses me by the kisses of His mouth. That's the description, Techazal, that's Limur HaTorah, where you're speaking and Hashem is speaking and it's one to one, and He instead says, Zayna. Yeah, nothing. No relationship.
I always wonder, this person is such a rush on Jesus, and he's so not shy by him to do that. To us, it's the most horrible thing in the world that was done, if it was actually done. But by him, he would have to feel, to him it's nothing, the Kodesh Kodesh. So why, is it such a horrible thing for him to do? Like, what does he care even? Blow up the building, destroy the building, unless he has some connection to what the potential kedusha is. That, you know what I'm saying? I always wondered what made him, what makes us believe that he did such a horrible thing in his own mind. It's not even shy by him that there's kedusha there.
I think two things. First on a practical level, and then on a reading agoda level. On a practical level, you know, Titus, it wasn't the idea that, you know, just he happened to have a date with a Zaina that night, and he was figuring out where to go, and his normal suite at the Waldorf was taken. So he said, you know, why don't we go to the Kodesh HaKodashim? Titus was doing something that was very, very pointed and very, very deliberate. Very, very pointed and very deliberate, and therefore were to read in it. You know, when somebody, you know, casually, you know, would do something, you know, a chveis, you know, if the Germans, you know, had a leather shortage and they said, oh, one second, I understand that the Jews have these scrolls of animal hide that they keep in these things, let's take it and we'll be able to use it to reinforce our army boots or something like that, that would be one thing. But when the soldiers, the Yimach Shema Mezichram, walked into the cities and the first thing they could do was rip open the Aron Kodesh, it's a different story. It's not, they don't know what's important. They know exactly what's important. They know that they're hitting there the jugular of the people. It's just, it's practically, this was a direct hit. It was meant that way. And we can't take it casually. And secondly, the Gemara doesn't tell us every aspect of every story. Just like the Chumash doesn't tell us every aspect of every story. I mean, you know, the Jewish people were in the Midbar for 38 years, and we don't have a whisper about what happened during those 38 years. We know what happened in the first year. We know what happened in the last year. We don't know anything happened in between. I mean, you know, we have some remnants of they traveled from this place to that place. That's it, right? In the middle of Parshas Chukos, we go from year 1 to year 40. Just, you know, one paragraph shift. Why? Because the Torah tells us things which are meaningful, which have consequence. If we would be reading Josephus, and he would tell us, and then he went and he knocked down one of the sconces that were on the wall of the Mikdash. What's the pshat that he knocked down one of the sconces on the Mikdash? There may not necessarily be such a meaning to that. But when the Gemara tells the same story, then there's a meaning to that. Because the Gemara is including, like, I mean, it's not the language, it's a language which is used by the Nevi'im, but it's Nevu'ah Shehutzra Chaladayres. You know, the Gemara says, not all the prophecies were written, and not all the prophecies which were written were even made part of the canon, part of the Tanakh. It's those which had impact, those which had meaning, those which were needed for the generations. And when we read an Agada in the Gemara, that's certainly the way it is. There's something to be read in, besides, again, for the practical aspect that obviously he meant something here. Okay, so that's the really to some degree the portrayal of Titus. He takes the sword and he throws it. You know, he stabs the pareches, and it begins to spurt blood. So, like, what's the idea? What's the purpose here? What's the tachlis here? Could I trouble you for the Gemara Yuma right behind you? Right behind you, there's a shas. Thank you very much. Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay. There's a Gemara in Yuma. The Gemara speaks about the. You might remember from the. This is wrong. It's not the wrong source. It's the right source. I was looking at the wrong sechta. Okay, the Gemara in Yuma speaks about the Trumas Hadeshem. You know, one of the avodos, one of the services in the Mikdash. First thing, really, to start off the day was they would take some of the ash from the previous day off of the Mizbeach. And this was sort of, you know, an early morning job. It wasn't the most remarkable job. It wasn't an offering. The opposite. It was actually taking something off of the Mizbeach. So in the beginning, you know, it wasn't necessarily the biggest competition to get this job. So they said, you know, whoever gets there first got there first. If, for some reason, a lot of people wanted to do it, they needed to have something, so they would get, a bunch of people would get up. So then the first thing they had was they had a race up the ramp. They said whoever gets up the ramp to the top of the ramp first gets to be the one to do it. Until a story happened where, right, they were heading into the stretch, right, and this guy's NASCAR ran the other ones off the road. You know, he pushed them off of the ramp. The fellow fell, broke his leg, and they said, okay, enough of that. From now on, We're doing rock, paper, scissors. We're doing, you know, stick out your fingers. We're gonna do a gyro, And that was what they ended up doing from then on in. The Gemara goes on as follows and says like this. Ma'aseh b'shnei kahanim. That's the story which is given in the Mishnah with what I just said. There was a story with two kahanim. She was shneim shavim v'ratzim v'elam v'kevesh. Right? They were even in the stretch. Kadam echad mehen l'seich arba amay shel chaveri. One of them went into ahead of the four amas of his friend. Natal sakin v'tokal loy b'libay, and he stabbed him. Yeah, he really wanted this job. Amad Rabbi Tzadok al malis ulam. Rabbi Tzadok stood on the steps of the ulam. The steps from the entry, from the foyer of the Heichel. And he said, Achenu Beis Yisrael, Shimu, my brothers here, Harei Weimer, Ki Motzei Chalal Ba'adama, V'yotzu Zekeinecha V'shoftecha. When you find an anonymous corpse, murder victim, right, so all the judges have to go out. Anu, Al Mila Havi Egla Arufa, Al Ha'ir Oyal Ha'azores. Look what happened here. We have a murder victim. How can we bring an Egla Arufa? This, of course, is a... I mean, there are 100 problems with the halacha comparison because everybody knows exactly what happened. But he was trying to make the people realize the remarkable tragedy that had occurred here. Go kulam b'vchi, and they were overwhelmed with tears. Ba'aviv shel tinek u'metzoik shum mefarper. The father of the young boy who was killed came, and he found him, and he found that he wasn't quite dead yet. He was still mefarper. He was still fluttering. He was still alive. Omar, he said, Harehu kapor aschem, v'adayin b'ni mefarper, loid nitma asakin. He said, well, he should be your kapora in place of the Egla Arufa. And he says, you know something? He's still alive. So he never made the knife tamei. So the Migdash isn't tamei. Let's get him out of here before he makes the Migdash tamei. Lamedcha, this teaches you. Shekosh aleim taras kelim, yoysem ishvichus tamei. That the concern for the purity of the kelim was beyond the concern for the shvichas damim, for the murder. Chen weimer, and so it says, v'gam dam naki shafach menashe harbe moed ad shem asher moleis Yerushalayim pelepe. Menashe spilled so much blood in Yerushalayim till it was like the streets were flowing with blood. This is what the Gemara says. So, you know, and the Gemara goes on and speaks about this. Says the Gemara, was it the idea that they treated Shvichas Damim casually, or was the idea that they treated Taras Kelim so significantly? What was it? Was it a cheapening of blood, or was it a over significance of Taras Kelim? Toshamami Tanasu Vatamu Gamdam Laki Shachmanash Shmam Nishchusun Mitzal Taras Kelim Vekayim Mekayim. Sounds like from the fact that they bring the pasuk of Menashe that the idea was that blood was cheap. It wasn't that they had such an exaggerated value of Tara, but that blood was cheap. That's the way the Gemara says it. That's the way the Gemara concludes. It's not a compliment. The Maral, interestingly, brings this as follows, and he says, you know, that this is hard. It's hard to. I mean, what he's saying is it's straightforward, but it's hard. He says that the presence of a life in a person, an neshama that's present in a person, is something of a divine presence. Right? It's life. It's vibrancy. The presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is possible only in an environment of Kedusha, of Tara, of purity. The presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the Migdash, in a certain sense, is a larger representation of the presence of Hashem than the presence of the life force in a person. And to some degree, he says, that's the sort of this tremendous, I don't know what to call it, paradox or irony that, you know, that these people here, they're concerned, he's thinking about the blood having been left, the purity having left, because you're dealing here both with the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with the presence of the sublime, with the presence of the neshama of it, you know, being here. And so in a certain sense, they would be able to say, okay, you know, we lost the one unit over here, but the Migdash, which is this totality of Klal Yisrael, and we're still able to preserve the purity, you know, that exists there. Now, the Maharal doesn't go on, at least here in this piece, doesn't go particularly on the fact that the Gemara doesn't consider it such a complimentary thing. But he's saying that it's not apples and oranges. It's not like, okay, here they were worried about X and they weren't worried about Y. They're like two completely unrelated things. There's a relationship between Tara, and there's a relationship between that and life. Both of them are about this idea of keeping the purity, keeping the spiritual in. And so there's a possibility of weighing one more, weighing the other one more. They're related to each other. And so he says that therefore, when Titus was here, and he was basically saying, I'm eradicating the presence of Hashem. I'm eradicating the presence of Hashem from this place. Like we talk about here, when we talked about the lack of chibur, the lack of connection. Like we talked about, I think, a couple of weeks ago, when we spoke about how the whole thing revolved around the Romans having to submit to the Jewish definition of a mikdash. Remember, that's why they sent their korban, and you know, the Jews weren't satisfied with it. Like Cain and Abel, was to remove the presence of Hashem from there. So therefore, the signs are similar, because the blood, the life force leaving the person, is very analogous to the presence of Hashem leaving the place. And so that's the idea. Killed Hashem. A loss of life means that the presence of Hashem has escaped from this body. And this is really what Titus was working to some degree to accomplish here. The loss of the presence of Hashem from the bias. This is pretty much the way he expresses this idea.
Adam wa nefesh.
And it's, you know, there's this notion of, you know, kihem chayenu, right? Well, you know, there's a maral. The maral speaks about this in the Ner Mitzvah, you know, coming from Chanukah. He says, I don't understand. Why do we celebrate the miracle of the candles? It's a miracle of salvation of the Jewish people is something which we celebrate. The candles wasn't salvation, so they were able to do a mitzvah, right? There's more to celebrate. There's something else to celebrate. And he says, no, the whole point over here was kiyem chayenu, that the mitzvahs and the presence of it, being able to restore the mikdash, is life. It's as much life as the fact that their blood wasn't spilled on the battlefield. It's the fact that they were able to restore the presence of Hashem in their midst. And that's very, very much part of this lesson of Chanukah. You know, the Yevonim say, look, you're alive, you're fine. You know, whether you're looking for something deeper, a deeper definition of life. But we say it and we repeat it, kihem chayenu v'ayrach yameinu. That's our life, right? Life is translated. Torah is translated into life itself. That's the way we're supposed to view it. When we're told to choose the good things to do, we're told choose life. V'acharta v'chayim. So therefore, on that metaphor, blood spurts from the pareiches when the presence of Hashem leaves the mikdash.
But wasn't the presence of Hashem already gone from the Midrash before, and
which allowed it to be destroyed.
So when Titus was there, it was kind of a moot point, wasn't it?
Yes and no. What do I mean? Yes, we say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence had already left, otherwise he wouldn't be able to do his thing. At the same time, we find the notion that the Gemara says that when they came in the first Mikdash, they found that the Kruvim were embracing each other. So they went and they showed it off to everybody. Look at these erotic images that they have in the Kodesh Kodashim. So in many Sfarim it asks, what do you mean they were embracing each other? You know, the whole Mikdash was destroyed because of the distance. Here they should have been like stony faced, you know, this one looking at this wall, this one looking at that wall. What's the idea that they're embracing each other? And there are different renditions of the answer, but it's really all the same. And the way I would say, you know, I'll tell you the metaphor the way the B'nai Yisachar says it, and then I'll tell you the way we would say, which I think is very real in life, very real in life. The way the B'nai Yisachar says it is like this: the rule is, the halacha is, you know, there are halachas. A husband has responsibilities. You know, intimate responsibilities to his wife, you know, even you know, for not simply for his own satisfaction, he's supposed to show affection. And there are, you know, there's boundaries and times for showing of affection. One of the times of showing affection, says the Gemara, is Yaitzel Aderach. The husband is going away, so before he goes away, he's supposed to make sure, you know, the evening before he goes away, he's supposed to make sure to have, you know, to dedicate time and intimacy to his wife. Says Bnei Yisachar, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was leaving. He was leaving. Now, you know, when somebody's going away for a long trip, you know, for 3 weeks before, they're not there. They're there, but they're not there, you know? But then, right before they leave, you know, they're supposed to make sure that they get back, you know, and they're together before they go. So he says, as HaKadosh Baruch Hu was, Hashem was distant, but in the moment of leaving, so there was the last embrace. That's what the Bnei Yisachar says. Beautiful, beautiful insight. But it's a very practical insight. Why? Think about the Jews in that time. Or think about the Jews in our time. You know, in the past 10 years, in the past 7 years, there is a much more tangible sense of connection that Jews have to Eretz Yisrael than they did before. Jews in America. Today, I'm saying religious Jews. Us, I'm not talking about secular Jews. I'm talking about religious Jews. The amount of focus, the amount of interest in moving to Eretz Yisrael and connecting to Eretz Yisrael is so much stronger. Why is that? One simple reason. Because it's at risk. Because it's about to lose it. In other words, we had this wonderful thing called Eretz Yisrael, this miracle to be restored to Eretz Yisrael, to the holiest place, to the place of our history and everything. And, you know, we just sort of like, we walked by it and we ignored it as if it wasn't there. And then we're about to lose it, and heaven forbid, Rachmana Litzlan, we feel, you know, some danger, some risk, and we suddenly say, whoa, you know, we grab onto it. When Klal Yisrael led up to the Beis HaMikdash, you know, led up to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, they were just completely insensitive to the holiness of the Mikdash. But you can be sure that when it was going up in flames, when the Romans were there, when Titus was doing whatever it was that he was doing, literally or figuratively, that the Jewish people realized what it was that they were losing. And all those dramatic stories that the Gemara tells about, you know, the keys and the, you know, to the heavens and everything else, you know, these were inspired by the tragedy. And at the moment of the tragedy, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is there. Hashem is there. He's not there in the sense that it was because he said, look, I'm going to have to pull out, that the Mikdash became a house of cards and was able to be destroyed by the Romans. Otherwise, it's not if Hashem wants. But on the other hand, before he leaves, he's really there. And it's true on so many levels. It's true with the loss of a Mikdash, it's true with the loss of anybody precious, you know, you like person ignored them, didn't pay attention to them, and then they're going. Suddenly there's a connection. You know, the person, you know, all the time they were ignored. Now they want to leave. You know, that's not going to make them stay. You know, that last warm thing, it's not going to make them stay, but it is a moment of connection nevertheless. So, you know.
Why is there still Kedusha there for Shema? You mean today?
Yeah. There's still Kedusha there as a Sada. What I mean is that, you know, the Mikdash grew. Avram Avinu saw it as a mountain, Yitzchak saw it as a field, Yaakov saw it as a house. Right? That's what the Gemara says. Avram Korah, how Yitzchak saw it. In other words, a mountain is just an empty, barren space. A field is developed. A house is the ultimate in development. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. And what does it say? Tzion, Sada Techarish, will be plowed up like a field. In other words, it went back from being a house to being something else. There's Shechina even when it's not a house. But as a house, it can't be a house. It can't be this private domicile of Hashem and His people. That's what Hashem pulled out of them. So the house fell. The house fell, but it was still a field. Hashem's presence is there. You know, setback. Okay, but this is beyond our discussion for today. Okay. There's more here. Those of you who were with us with the Be'er HaGa'ilah will remember. I'm just going to do one more piece, but some of it we referenced in the Be'er HaGa'ilah when we learned really towards the end of the Be'er HaGa'ilah when we spoke about the story, which is part of this Gemara, which he speaks about here as well, which is about how Titus died, which the Gemara says that the Yatush, that the insect entered his brain and was pecking at it for 7 years, remember, and then they split open his brain. So we talked about that then, and we could talk about it again now, but we won't because of the time. And Mirat Hashem, next week we will be nether, hopefully be able to finish this parak with the Unculus story, right? Unculus, the nephew of Titus, who became one of ours. However, there's one last piece that I want to just do with you here, and briefly, and that is as follows. So the Gemara brings that when Titus destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, famously, from the, as we know, from the arch of Titus, right, he took all of the kelim, he took the pareches down, he spread it out, he took all of the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash, he threw them in the pareches, then he pulled the ends of the curtain together, he made it like a big basket, a big sack, and he carted it off to Rome. Took it with him to Rome. Right? So it sits in Rome. It sits in Rome. You see, right, the Arch of Titus, which portrays Titus parading through the streets of Rome with
the Vatican.
Right, in the Vatican. That's where it is. That's the Vatican. The Vatican is the heir to Malchus Reini, to the Roman Empire. It's in Rome, and they have those kelim. That's why we identify. I mean, it's a manifestation of our identification of Christianity with the last Malchus. No, the Arch of Titus is not in the Vatican. No. The Arch of Titus is just a depiction. The Arch of Titus is in Rome. It's on a street in Rome. But it's a depiction of the stuff which they brought back. The parade through the streets of Rome. But the actual kalim, whatever it is that exists, is reportedly in the subterranean vaults of the Vatican. Okay, but the Gemara says just one thing to finish. Says the Gemara, he took them to boast in his city. Shenemar, as it says, V'chein ra'isi rishoyim kivurim. I've seen rishoyim, right? This is a pasuk in Kehelis. I've seen rishoyim, evil people, kivurim, buried. Uvo, and they came. Umimokim kadosh yahalechu, and from a holy place they travel. V'yishtakchu be'ir, and they'll be forgotten in the city asher kein asu, that which they did. So the Gemara says, now that's quite an interesting one. Buried Rishoyim coming and being forgotten in the city about what they did, says the Gemara, no. What you have to do is you have to modify the reading of the Pasuk. Al tikri kivurim elo kivutzim. Don't read it as buried, but rather kivutzim, gathered. In other words, these gatherings of Rishoyim, or these ones who are gathering the spoils. And don't read it as vayishtakhu, and they'll be forgotten, but rather as vayishtabchu. So just change one letter in kivurim, and it goes from buried to assembled. Just change one letter in vayishtakhu, and it goes from forgotten to praised, to boasted. And that was the idea. That was what he did. So the Maharal is intrigued by this notion of changing the words the way they occur here. So he says like this. Excuse me. This is on page Kuf Chafei in here, and the idea is V'chein Reisi Rishoyim. He says they had to make this Lamed Dalet in the classic. He says they had to make this drasha because again, what's talking about? They're buried and they're traveling. Like what's going on? And how can you say that? And so therefore they have to change it. And instead of buried, that they're in fact going on to something bigger. V'yishtakhu had to be changed because even though they. But so it's true. Excuse me. One second. And the other way around. So while the pasuk had to be read differently, but on the other hand, with all of their gathering and their pomp and circumstance, they're kfurim. They're buried. With all of their vayishtakhu, all of their praise vayishtakhu, ultimately they're forgotten. And I just want to explain this briefly with two things. One with a Torah idea, and finally with a story. To me, it's one of the most moving stories that I've heard and that I try to repeat on occasion. The machshava, the thought is like this. Rome is the descendant of Esav. Esav faced the opportunity of the ultimate. He was the Bechar. He was the firstborn of Yitzhak Avinu. He could have had everything. And he rejected it. He negated. Vayivez Esav as ha-Bechar. What did he say? He said, Hine anechi ha-lech lamus. I'm going to die. What do I need the Bechar for? Now, simple pshat, of course, was he was so taken by the fits of hunger and heat and whatever it was from his hard day at the fields that if he wouldn't have something to eat, he was going to pass out, he was going to disappear. But Chazal understand, come on, he wasn't dying of hunger. Right? He wasn't dying of hunger. If he was dying of hunger, maybe it would have made sense what he did. Right? But instead, the idea was like this. The Bechaira wasn't a double portion in his in Yitzchak's 401k. Right? The Bechaira was the birthright, the eternal spiritual connection and value. And Esav was a human being of physicality. So to him, life was about the material, the physical things. And when life is about the material, physical things, so you might be very focused on that, but you know what? Hine anechi helech lamus. I am going to die. I'm not going to be here forever. Right? It's the mortality. The difference between a Yaakov and an Esav is that Yaakov sees himself as getting past this world, this Alma de Shikra, because there's a world of eternity to live for. There's a world beyond all of these things. And Esav, it's the opposite. Esav is the Koheles man who says, no, let's eat and drink because tomorrow we're going to be dying. We might as well get whatever it is that we can. So Titus is there and he's triumphing over Yaakov Avinu. He's destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. He's taking the spoils of the Holy of Holies and he's going and he's boasting through the streets of Rome. They're gathering together and they're showing the world and they're showing off all of their success. Yeah, that's the way you read it. But you know what is, the way it's spelled in that Chumash? It's the Rishayim Kivurim. They're dead. You know there it's Vishtabchu and they praise Vishtakhu. They'll be forgotten. For us, right, in Chazal, we see constantly that forgetting something is death. Right, the idea, it was there and it's gone. Right, we want to always, a person dies, but we say, let there be Yad Vashem, let there be some trace, let there be something remembered from this. But it becomes, and it disappears, it becomes nothing. It becomes nothing. So we tell Esav, you're boasting. Yeah, fine, Gevaldik, right? This is your day in the sun. The Roman Empire triumphed, conquered Jerusalem. They come back victorious with their spoils of war, walking through the cities. But remember, Esav, according to your own definition, according to your own definition of life, this is all fleeting. Kivurim, Yishtakhu. It'll be buried. It'll be forgotten. That's the between the lines here. And that's what I want to end with this story. The Panavizhurav was, I think this is the first story I ever said about the Panavizhurav, by the way. For those of you who daven here regularly, you know that I've been on a little bit of a Panavizhurav kick, right? But this is the first story I ever said about Panavizhurav, and I heard it from Rabbi Frand. The Panavizhurav, just to understand who it was, Panavizhurav lost his wife and his children, except for one, in the Holocaust. They were murdered by the Nazis. He was sent from the community of the whole Lita during the brief window when Lithuania was, areas of Lithuania were immune to the persecution of the Nazis, right? So he was sent as part of the government, as part of a government thing, to find a solution for where the Jews could go. And he was sent to Eretz Yisrael, and he never went back. He never went back. While he was in Eretz Yisrael, all hell broke loose. Excuse the expression, but it's an appropriate expression. And the whole city of Panevish, the whole yeshivas and institutions of Panevish, and his wife and his children, except for his son Rav Avram, who had already left, were all slaughtered, were all killed. And the Panevish Rav, instead of becoming a depressed person, the Panevish Rav was a fire, and he was determined to rebuild constantly. And he would travel the world. If you come across any older Jew, right, who was part of the observant community in America in the 50s, right, you ask them if they ever met the Panevizhurav. And if they did, you will see their eyes glisten. I guarantee you. I guarantee you. Every time I say a story about the Panovich Rav, I look at the older people who are in the audience, and they're all like a completely different look on their face. He was a magnificent, magnificent person. Panovich Rav went to Rome. He went to Rome for one of his many trips in order to raise funds for the rebuilding of Judaism, which he was doing. He went to Rome, and he had a connection. He had a person in Rome. He arrived in Rome, and he arrived, and he called immediately this person, and he said, "I want you to come, and I want you to pick me up right now." So he said, "Panovich Rav, right now?" He says, "It's 10 o'clock at night, and it's pouring rain." He says, "I want you to come and pick me up right now." So he went and he picked him up. And he says, "I want you to take me to the Arch of Titus." And he drove him to the Arch of Titus. And the Panovich Rav got out of the car. And he looked up at the Arch of Titus, portraying them taking the Kelim out of Beis HaMikdash. And he straightened out his kapota and his hat in the rain. And he said, "Titus, Titus." Says, "We're still here. Where are you? Where are you?" Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker. That's Rishoyim Kivurim. The Ishtakhu, the Ishtapchu, they boast, right? They think they're so great, big gatherings of the Romans. They're gone. The Roman Empire. What's the Roman Empire? What's the Roman Empire? Right? The Roman Empire is the fashion. It's the fashion capital of the world, right? You know, that's what it is. It's the Roman Empire. You're gone. There's nothing. There's nothing. And Klal Yisrael is still here. And this is the Panovich Rav, right? Where Klal Yisrael was destroyed under his feet, but Klal Yisrael was still there because he was rebuilding it, and he was successful because Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker. That's really the difference between Esav and Yaakov. Esav, who is the destroyer, is subject ultimately to the most destruction of them all. Yeah, he writes his own ticket. Right? That the Maral goes on. We're not going to talk about it, but the Maral goes on when he talks about the death and the ultimate punishment of Titus, burned up, separated, spread over the seas, cremated. Right? That's right. You're a destroyer. You're a destroyer. A destroyer. A destroyer. You know what happens to destroyers? They disappear. But we're not destroyers. We're creators of connection. Right? We're not the Zayna, but we're the Kodesh HaKadoshim. We're creators of connection. We're still here. We're still here. And that's the difference. Okay.
To what degree can a Jew apply metaphor? In other words, where do we spurs it stop? Obviously we can apply for Gemara. We can't apply for Torah, or can we?
Right.
Torah is the word of Hashem.
Right. No, we
That's why you're ready.
Sorry?
That's why you're ready.
Yeah. It's a very, very serious and complex question. When could you say that something is metaphoric? We don't say that Kriyas Yamsuf is metaphoric.
So,
the Rajba, who was one of the Gedolei Rishonim, has a tshuva, where he has a response, and where he says that we have mesoros about things which happened. We have a Messiah about things which happen. And there are other things where we don't have a specific Messiah that they happen. And if we don't have a specific Messiah that they happen, so then there's room for interpretation that it's metaphoric. The stories in the Chumash, we have a very clear Messiah that they happened as they are recorded. The stories in the Gemara, we don't have necessarily the same. We don't have the same tradition.
The same thing is true with the other books of Moshe, Joshua.
By and large, we have Nesiris on many of those things in the Tanakh. Not on everything, but on many of those things.